you know, when we hitch ourselves to larger political movements, there's a real possibility we can get absorbed into that machine. And we have to really recognize that just because we're having conversations and maybe we're sharing, you know, the same convention space as a Donald Trump or a Vivek Ramaswamy or whoever, that doesn't translate to real power. Okay, well, you know, DOGE is doing a good thing, but the Republicans and Democrats both had a hand in creating the system that allowed that abuse, fraud, and waste to happen, right? We need to inject ourselves in the conversation in a way that we're not borrowing rhetoric from the Republican or Democratic parties, but we're injecting ourselves in a way that people know what we want, and, you know, we encourage good behavior, but we ask for what we really want.
That some people feel very hurt from things that have past happened to the party, and we need to be able to work to get past that and come to work together in the party to meet our goals going forward into the future. But the turnover in the Libertarian Party, I think the Mises Caucus would have become dominant at a time without all the takeover rhetoric, just because there's a natural cycle.
It remains to be seen. I don't think the caucus has as much power as it did coming in 2022, nor the enthusiasm it once had. I do think the caucus brought in a lot of young people. I think it brought in a lot of more Rothbardian messaging, a lot of more hardcore messaging. I think that where they made one fatal mistake was the aggressive rhetoric of the takeover, which made a lot of people that were in the party uncomfortable that their presence was going to, you know, basically come in and kick everybody out, that kind of thing.
Today, we are joined by Stephen Nikayla and Paul Darr, the newly appointed chair and vice chair of the Libertarian Party. They are assuming their positions during a time when the organization is at a crossroads. There's allegations of embezzlement from the former chair that resigned last month. The Libertarian presidential nomination itself was rife with accusations of malfeasance. Membership and revenue has dropped drastically over the last several years. In addition to all this, the party must decide whether to join in with MAGA or stand out as a distinct political party. So stay tuned and find out how Stephen and Paul assess the past, present, and future of the Libertarian Party.
So I was first going to kind of start off with a hard question, like, why is the Libertarian Party turned so MAGA? And then I saw your tweet today, Stephen, and it said that a seat at the table means nothing if you're on the menu. And I quite like that phrase. Seems like you have the right mindset going forward with the Libertarian Party. But exactly how do you divorce the Libertarian Party from MAGA? Because to me, it's almost one. I was at the convention last year, and I couldn't tell if I was at a Trump rally or a third party convention.
Absolutely. Well, to our credit, when Trump did go and speak on stage, I saw a lot of booing from the libertarian crowd on a lot of issues. So I think there is still a very strong ideological, I guess you could call it a purity testing vibe in the Libertarian Party, which has its pros and cons. Because one thing people need to remember, we as a Libertarian Party, we are political philosophy. So we are going to judge people by the merits of that philosophy, and where people like Trump or others fall short, you know, we are going to check them when they get out of line, and nobody should be surprised when we do so. And so I thought long and hard before I put out that tweet today, which seems to be making its rounds. And the point isn't to say that it's bad to try to get a political prisoner released, or it's bad to form single issue coalitions, or it's bad to say, hey, you know, Doge is a good thing, but how do we take it even further? The problem becomes, you know, when we hitch ourselves to larger political movements, there's a real possibility we can get absorbed into that machine. And we have to really recognize that just because we're having conversations and maybe we're sharing, you know, the same convention space as a Donald Trump or a Vivek Ramaswamy or whoever, that doesn't translate to real power. Real power comes from having leverage, and having leverage, it starts with building the infrastructure to actually go out and attain power. So what does that look like? What does that mean? Right. We're looking to field 500 libertarian candidates in 2026 and 2028. So we're looking to win at the local level. When we start winning local races, getting libertarians elected into positions of power and authority, then we have a model of libertarian governance that we can say, hey, you know, this is a model, it's working. You know, would you like to put money towards making this happen and expanding this? And when we start gaining ground, it's a lot easier to defend than it is to attack. So when we start gaining ground, getting libertarians in positions of power, building up dominance in certain areas, then we become a real threat. When we get I think Gary Johnson in some states got 4.5%. I think he got 4% total. Joe Jorgensen beat the spread in many states. These are things that scare people like Donald Trump and even Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris, because all of a sudden they start having libertarian talking points, or they start saying, oh, I'm a libertarian. And the reason they're doing that is because they're trying to get the libertarian voting bloc to vote for them, because they know that we can sway an election. So for them, it's more of a tactical move. But for us, it shouldn't be the strategy to say, well, you know, we got 4% last election, so, you know, we can just keep asking for favors and concessions from the old two parties, and they're going to give it to us because, you know, they respect us. They don't respect us. They want to absorb our people. So it's very, very important to understand that doesn't mean we have to be contrarian every time they do something that we might agree with. But I think it's important as libertarians that we say, okay, well, you know, DOGE is doing a good thing, but the Republicans and Democrats both had a hand in creating the system that allowed that abuse, fraud, and waste to happen. So we need to recognize that. But we could also say, look, the next step is audit the Pentagon or audit the Fed and end it, right? We need to inject ourselves in the conversation a way that we're not borrowing rhetoric from the Republican or Democratic parties, but we're injecting ourselves in a way that people know what we want. And, you know, we encourage good behavior, but we ask for what we really want, which is to topple the system that allowed these abuses to take place. So there's my long-winded answer for you. I hope it answered the question somewhat.
No, I definitely believe in the Libertarian Party to have power and to have force and have a say on the stage. We can't just adopt another party there. We have to be our own distinct party, have our voice in the conversation through the power that we have within the party. And we can't be just begging for scraps from the other parties. We need to have our voting bloc that's what they want and they're chasing after. And we can't just concede and let it go to them there. But
I completely agree with you all on that, because it was a little much. The MAGA was getting a little too much in the party. Now, I know y'all have only been in your positions for like less than a month now, but you came to your positions because the previous chair stepped down, Angela McArdle, and she's faced some allegations of embezzlement, doing some funny things with money. Do you have any update on if that actually happened? Will you be transparent with Libertarian Party members so they know what happened with their money? If there was something funny going on, are y'all going to take any sort of legal action on that? Because to me, when you hear the Libertarian Party might be doing funny things with the cash, it's like when you hear a pastor's out cheating with prostitutes or something. Like, this is not vibe. Y'all are supposed to be good with the money. That's the one thing libertarians are supposed to be good at.
Absolutely. Well, we did form an investigatory committee to investigate some discrepancies and some things that came out of the Jake Porter newsletter, news report that I'm sure most people are familiar with in regards to Freedom Calls LLC. Now, I can't speak too much on this topic as it is an ongoing investigation and something both Paul and I are a part of, but we will be taking an impartial look at this and doing whatever we need to within our bylaws and our fiduciary duty and take whatever corrective action we see fit as a board. So we will be transparent and open with the membership, but we do want to make sure we go through the whole process and, make sure we do a good job there first.
Since Angela took over, membership went down for the Libertarian Party by 18%, and a non-convention revenue was cut by almost half. So her leadership wasn't very great at growing the party or even increasing, you know, cash on hand. How do the two of you all plan to bring the Libertarian Party back and get more members and also increase cash so you can run candidates? How do you do that?
Great question. I think there's been an emphasis on what does winning look like as a libertarian party. And I can tell you from as a chairman of the party, and I'm sure as vice chairman, Paul would agree, our job is to grow the party, increase fundraising, increase membership, get libertarians elected, and, you know, form coalitions and affect legislature, of course, and, you know, spread the message. But ultimately, our fiduciary duty to the board is what is best for the organization. Where do we need to go? So for me as a businessman, I'm in the fast food world. I'm also in the full service restaurant world. It's all about making money, right? It's about expanding. It's about getting new customers. And the same thing for the LP. We need to not only not only reach out to find new libertarians, but we need to recapture the people that we've lost for various reasons over the past few years. So it starts there. And that happens through a very data-driven look at, okay, you know, let's segment the data. Let's make sure we have the right data. We have the right messaging. We're making the right asks. We're retaining people. We're always getting new people. So there's a method to the madness there. It's the 21st century, so everything is data-driven. So I do believe it starts with making sure we're in constant contact with our people. I think it also has a lot to do with uniting the party and bringing the whole Libertarian Party forward and, you know, saying, okay, look, if you agree with 70-80% of our platform, you belong here, and you should be welcomed in, and you should be a part of this mission to grow the movement and to gain political power and wield it in order to defend liberty. I think that's a very powerful thing. And I think the party also needs to offer more of a value-driven approach as well as a mission-driven approach. So that means supporting things like Defend the Guard, which the board voted to have as one of our official missions back in August in Miami, which is a program. It's legislation driven by the state level to make sure that National Guardsmen aren't deployed overseas in undeclared wars. I think it's a worthy project. We're fighting for ballot access, of course. That requires a lot of funding to do so and making sure we go out there and try to change the laws and keep libertarians on the ballot in different states. You know, ultimately it means representing the party for everybody. And, you know, I think for me personally, it means being a bit of a zealot and an apologist for the libertarian message and for, you know, what we stand for as a party. So when you combine all those different things, you know, hopefully it gives people enough incentive to say, hey, you know what? I like what these guys are doing. I want to sign back on. And so far, Paul and I have definitely seen a renewed enthusiasm to get people back in the party. Where our mission's just starting. We're still, you know, we're 3 weeks in, not even a month in. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But we're looking at every avenue for fundraising, to raise membership, and to incentivize people to get back into the Libertarian Party. And, you know, it's going to take some time, but we're confident we can do it, and we're looking forward to it.
I just love Stephen's business experience and how he has been able to use his experience there and knowing how to reach out to customers as part of the party, and thinking of our membership out there and how to reach out to our party members that are our customers and our voters that are their customers out there, and trying to target out there to make sure that we're actually giving them the product out there that they want to see out in the marketplace of ideas. So he's really trying to reach out to everybody out there and knows how to do that in a very business-oriented sense and has the experience as he's delved into things there. And I have a big heart and a lot of compassion for all the parts of the party here. And I've been trying to share that with others, as many people that know me in the party know that side of me from the party, as I try to work with the heal that divide with that some people feel very hurt from things that have past happened to the party. And we need to be able to work to get past that and come to work together in the party to meet our goals going forward into the future. So that is a big part of what I'm trying to do also, is reach out to those individuals and to try to get us to find that path forward so that we can help achieve that vision that Stephen was sharing about having all those candidates out there running. And I think that's where we really need to be competing. If we're going to compete in anything in the party, it's having the best candidates out there running in the party. If you want to compete on something, have that candidate out there, see who can have the best ones getting elected to office out there. That's where I want to see competition in the party at.
And I think drawing off Paul's point, Courtney, you know, I find personally the best way to unite people who may have different opinions or different outlooks or whatever is to come together and say, hey, you know, what do we agree on? What are our actual goals? And if we can agree on a set of goals, then it doesn't become a matter of, well, you know, I think we should be doing this, or no, we should be doing that. And it's, you know, fighting over who gets the authority or whatever. It's about, okay, these are our goals. We agree that these are our goals. You don't have to like each other, but at least work together towards those goals. And when you put people to work and you put your aces in their places and you have a diverse group of folks coming together and say, yeah, we want to get libertarians elected. Yeah, like we want to be relevant. Yes, we want to see, you know, certain legislation passed or certain single issues put forward. then it becomes less about the factionalism and less about what divides us and more about the mission. And for me, that's the ultimate goal. It's like, okay, you know, we're either successful or we're not. We don't have these very lofty ideas of what success is. We've put it on paper and we're moving the same direction. So at least as a Libertarian National Committee, that's very important. And I will say, you know, Paul might be very humble on this, but he's very personable and he's a great fundraiser. So he's been doing a really good job reaching out to people and addressing, you know, their concerns, bringing them back into the fold and getting them to commit. So I do thank Paul on that.
I kind of want to circle back to something that Paul mentioned a minute ago about running great candidates. Now, I might kind of ruffle feathers with this question, but a lot of libertarians haven't been too pleased with the presidential candidates we've had for a while. Gary Johnson, Jorgensen, Chase Oliver. I know I see the signs in your background there. They're kind of viewed as libertarian light, I guess. They're just weak candidates. Do you think that's been part of the problem? Do you think we should have more hardcore libertarian presidential nominees and that would increase party support? Or do you think that's not an issue and it's just trolls on the internet that they complain?
That's a good question. You know, the delegates, of course, select the candidate, and not everybody's going to be happy with who the candidate is. Every campaign is different. Every campaign is limited by their ability to raise funds and to build the infrastructure into the campaign that they need to do to be successful. So, you know, how much is ideological versus how much is getting the right donors? I think it's probably both to varying degrees. I mean, Gary Johnson, for all the criticism about Bill Weld, and I certainly emphasize with a lot of it, you know, Bill Weld brought in a lot of money, and that's why Gary Johnson was able to reach 4.5% of the vote in some states. So money is important. I don't want to pretend it's not. And as far as, you know, the messaging and the candidate, the presidential election has always been a search and rescue operation. You know, they go out there and they talk about libertarian ideas, and it's always been a pivotal moment for us every 4 years to fundraise and get new blood into the party and sort of renew that enthusiasm. And it always depends on what's going on in the current state of affairs with politics and how their message reaches voters. You know, I think Donald Trump did a good job of reaching out to people in terms of, you know, inflation is this and blah, blah, blah. And they, you know, he did a good job there, even though he, of course, you know, the Republican Party had a lot to do with creating that inflation, even under him. And, you know, of course, the Federal Reserve prints money. But I think, you know, one of the pieces of advice I would give a future libertarian candidate is, even at the local levels, reach out to people to where they are and pull them in. Because for all the criticism of, well, you know, Gary Johnson was Republican light or this or that, I got into the party because of Gary Johnson. He pulled me in back in 2012 when I was at Paul Fest in Tampa, and I thank him for bringing me in. And so, you know, I think even if you take a Chase Oliver or a Joe Jorgensen or a Gary Johnson and you present their ideas to the mainstream, I think all of those ideas are actually quite radical compared to mainstream politics. So, you know, I think we can still move the Overton window with our candidates. I think that really for the future, for 2028, that presidential campaign, whoever it ends up being, and I'm agnostic to who it is personally, but whoever it is, they just need to make sure that they are looking at the political landscape, and they're going to have to carve their way in through whatever the hot topic issue of the day is, because 10 years ago, inflation wasn't as big of an issue as it is now. War and the looming threat of World War III wasn't as big of an issue as it is now. You know, there's different issues. There's going to be different speakers, and there's going to be different people that resonate, of course, with the delegates, but also with the American people. And, you know, as chair, I'm not partial to anybody in particular, but I'll say this matters just as much at the local level too. It's about meeting the people where they are. And, you know, I think there's certain lessons to be learned there. But yeah, to go back to your original point, I think for the party, you could have the most radical Rothbardian out there, you know, really preaching radical libertarian ideas, or you're going to have, you know, different sets of people. It's going to attract, you know, different audiences, but it's going to bring people out in the Libertarian Party. And, you know, I think, you know, it's just going to depend. It's going to depend on the time. Yeah.
just kind of takes all flavors of libertarianism, I guess, to kind of bring new people in. So even if it's not the strongest candidate, it might have grown the party kind of in a way. Is that kind of back and around? I didn't vote for any of the last three. I mean, I still feel forced to vote in the two-party system because I get such what I consider weak candidates. Sure. And I don't know if I'm like the most hardcore libertarian that ever existed,
right,
you know?
Right, absolutely. Like I said, my advice to the next candidate would be to really, really look at where the people are. And that's the kind of the messaging that I'm hoping for the party. As for the candidate, you know, I'm not on their advisory panel per se, but I do believe that it's easier to defend ideas that are more hardline libertarian than they are to defend ideas that are lukewarm. So, it's up to the candidate. It's up to the candidate.
Okay. You don't have much.
But yeah.
Okay. Well, last election cycle, after Chase Oliver got his nomination, I just remember receiving all these emails from the party moaning and groaning that he stole it. And I'm thinking, why is the Libertarian Party complaining about their own process? Like, if you're really having your own election stolen from you, shouldn't you fix that yourself? I mean, how do you even deal with that when you come into the party as your position? I mean, would you have done that, went around and said, hey, our candidate stole the election? And did he even steal the election? That type of stuff, I think, to me, really keeps a lot of people out because it looked like a giant dumpster fire. Sure.
Yeah, he won. It was the last round. And, you know, a lot of people obviously didn't get their candidate of choice. I don't know if I could blame the process for that. That's just kind of how things shaked up at the end. There was a strong push towards Noda, of course, Noda versus Chase Oliver. So not everybody was satisfied. And look, you know, I can't, you know, it's, you know, again, it's up to the delegates to really decide. It's not my decision who gets in. But yeah, I guess it's really a matter of forging alliances. If, you know, there was different alliances and things fell apart and it was a very dramatic night at the floor. I think we got out close to 1 a.m. I was door dashing beer by the end of it to hand out to different delegations because it was an endurance of a convention. So, I mean, you know, for me, the party must support its candidates, right? The party, the leadership. That's kind of the crux of the question. I can't force the rank and file members to support our candidate. It's going to be ultimately up to them who they support. I do expect party leadership to support the candidate, regardless of who it is. And as far as the LNC's role in the presidential process, you know, we've always done what we can to support our candidates in the past. I think that's something that's a policy that, you know, we should definitely continue. And making sure they're, you know, have the tools they need to be successful. But ultimately, and this is something that the delegates need to understand, it's that the party itself doesn't have, you know, a war chest of millions of dollars to give to the candidates. So when they go on to become, to work on their campaign, they are starting from a position of, okay, you know, we got to get the donors, we have to have a campaign plan, we have to have a strategy, we need to have a data plan, we need to know how we're going to use it, we need to know whose podcast we're going to appear on, what news stations we're going to appear on, what's our platform. So I guess speaking to that, my advice is more for future candidates. It's like, look, if you want to get involved in this process, you want to run for president, you need to have those boxes checked, because the reality is, you know, the LNC isn't just going to hand you, here's a presidential campaign in a box to go and run for office. You know, what is your mission? Is the mission to win the presidency? You know, it's probably not likely. So what is the gauge of success? Is it to get libertarians into the movement? You know, and then how do you do that, and who's going to fund it? And, you know, I've run for office before for local city commission in Key West, District 4. And I've helped candidates run for office, and, you know, you gotta know where your money's coming from. You got to appeal to the people, find out, you know, what matters most to people, and what matters most to people today might not matter to them in 4 years. So I don't know if any of that answered your question, but I hope it at least gave.
No, it did. I'll stop popping on the candidates, but I was just kind of, it's just such a mess last year. I was just curious, like, how y'all navigated it, what your thoughts were. I do want to ask a question about the overall operation of the Libertarian Party. I've kind of been in and out of it for the last 10 years. I went to the Columbus, Ohio, when they had the national convention there about a decade ago. And then I went this last year. And I was just curious, because y'all are at a higher level of the Libertarian Party. I just engage with it as a pedestrian here. Are you aware of how messy and inefficient the party is? I mean, it to me is more inefficient than the government. No emails get responded. I was trying to get a press pass last year. I called. It went straight to voicemail. Nobody called back. No one responded to the emails. I've tried to offer to help run candidates, run campaigns, fill out this form. We'll get back to you. And I'm just going in this like giant circle. I could go on and on. I won't bore you with the stories. But and other people told me the same thing when I went to the convention. I thought, well, maybe it's just me. Or, you know, maybe the Libertarian Party's turning into the GOP and they don't really want women around here. And that's fine, too. Do what you want. We don't want women around. But I was sitting there at the table waiting for Kennedy to come out. And they're like, oh, no, nobody got back to me. Emails go unanswered. Half the people said I just snuck in through the door and didn't even buy a ticket because I couldn't get anybody to answer my questions. So first off, do you know how messy it is top to bottom at like the grind level? And how do you fix that mess? Because it's a big task to do.
Sure. Well, let's actually, I didn't know all that, but I'm not completely surprised either. I think one thing that makes me uniquely positioned to be chair, especially at this moment, is the business experience. And for me, the small details are what matter the most. You know, I've had the pleasure, and so has Paul, the last few weeks of really getting to know our staff, our internal operations. And a big piece of this for me is finding out, okay, you know, where are our opportunities? Where can we do things better? Where are our strengths? You know, how do we tighten up these loose ends? That's what we do in business. We just bought two new Wendy's restaurants in Miami back in December. These were failing restaurants. Corporate sold them to us because they were failing. They had high food costs. They had low margins. I think they were probably losing money by the time we took them over. You know, issues with customer service, issues with facilities, you know, you name it. There was problems, right? We come in and it's been about 3 months now. Sales are positive. Labor's down. Customer service has improved quite a bit. You know, training is there. Facilities are looking much better. Customers are coming back that haven't been there in years because they feel like, wow, I see changes. You know, we got rid of a lot of problems. And that happens through experience. And sometimes I think it takes somebody with that eye to detail to say, okay, you know, I see these issues. How can we improve? I'm working on even getting some operational consultants to come in to take a further look at what we can do to be better. And really look internally outwards, because if you don't have really good operations, then it's hard to be good at doing anything else and getting these projects done. I'm on the board of directors for the Key West Greater Chamber of Commerce, and been in the nonprofit world as well as the for-profit world for quite some time. I do some stuff in emergency preparedness with communications for Monroe County. So, you know, all these things require the ability to lead a team, but also the ability to know operations, know numbers, you know when something is a good or bad deal, et cetera, et cetera. And to your point, you said you couldn't get anybody to get back to. And I apologize about that. And I'll definitely look into that to see what broke down that nobody got back to for a press pass. And people were just, I guess, going into an event because they couldn't even figure out how to pay for it. So it's kind of like, you know, government bureaucracy. And then people just say, well, screw it, I'm gonna do the illegal thing anyway, because I can't get a legal answer. Right. So yeah, it doesn't reflect very well on us, but I appreciate you bringing that to my attention so I can address it. So I will look into that. But essentially my goal right now for the past 3 weeks and probably for the next few months is, of course, creating a strategic plan as far as fundraising and membership and all the projects you want to do goes. But a big part of why I'm so excited to get my feet wet is because I'm really good at operations and I'm good at fixing things when they're broken. So having the opportunity to really, really get into the LNC and look at, okay, you know, here's everything A to Z, and saying, you know, how do we take advantage of this, or how do we fix this, or whatever. These things take time. But it's not something you can fix unless you completely steep yourself in it. So Paul and I have been working basically a second full-time job for the past month, you know, putting in crazy hours every single day. And that's been a positive for us, because the closer we get to the inside of party operations, the more and more clear it's like, okay, cool. We have opportunities to do really good things. So from that perspective, from a business perspective, and this is probably boring for most people to even consider because it's not as sexy as, well, we're going to free Ross on Tuesday, or, you know, on Wednesday, we're going to, you go run this campaign or that campaign, but this is really important stuff. And from a membership perspective and a donor perspective, I think it's really important for our members to understand that, you know, we are looking at things and we want to make things more efficient. And I take your donor dollars very seriously, even more serious than how I spend my own money, because it's not my money. So I hope that next convention, when you ask for your press pass, it'll be a very, very simple, easy process to get it. And I think we've got really good teams in place for the next convention, and we've got a really good staff, and you know, we're just working on making things a lot more efficient to stretch every dollar, because we work on a Spartan budget, and you know, we need to be as efficient as possible with what we have.
Okay. Yeah, I hope it doesn't sound like, I know you probably just deal with nothing but complaints since you started, because everybody brings their problems to That's you since job. You took over. My job. But it's been like this
my job
for like 10 years. I thought like over a decade, I thought surely the Libertarian Party's got their act together better than this. And it's just like, I eventually got my press pass, but it was just nightmare. Do you have anything to add to that, Paul?
Myself, I live out here in Texas, and those that know the Texas affiliate of the Libertarian Party out here know that we're very business oriented in how we run the party out here, and very professional. Even between our paid staff and our unpaid volunteer staff that are out here. So I've been looking at many of the operations that LP National does, comparing them to how our state party, being such a large professional party, has some lessons that I can take from that and share and improve on some of our business practices too, that I feel that we can improve that. And I've already seen improvements as I've talked to staff about how, from your experience, I don't think you would have the same experience today that you had then with how staff are operating today. And they're also going to add in different automations to things in the future that'll further streamline the process. So when you send in that, you know, email to info@lp.org, it'll get routed to the individual as those automations go in, and in less physical handling, so that things don't get dropped out there. So it'll get to where it needs to go, and stuff like that'll just be smooth going forward. So I'm looking forward as those automations go in for our staff, and as our staff is already more professional than you were describing at that time currently. So we should be able to have a better experience next time around. And I hope to be able to share a few lessons I've learned out here in Texas and share that with National to improve our business practices there.
Cool. Okay. So you're kind of aware and you're on it. Okay. Sounds good. next question. I asked this to the Libertarian candidates interviewed last year. Why do you think there are so few female libertarians involved in the party? The way I think about it, if every man that's in the Libertarian Party brought in one woman, their wife, their girlfriend, their niece, their cousin, there's some woman in every man's life they know, why can't they convince them to be a libertarian? Why do you think women are just repelled by the party and don't want to be there?
Question. I've been in the party since 2014. And my observation, quite frankly, has been that over the past 10 years, I've seen more women in the party now than ever before. And not only that, but I've seen a much younger demographic in the party than ever before. I think that as the Libertarian Party has become a bit more of a household name and more mainstream, it's become less of a fringe movement to more of a, hey, you know, these people, they wear, some of them wear suits and ties, and they're a professional, and they're actually trying to make a difference. And with that, you're seeing a lot more women join. You're seeing a lot more young people than ever before. Paul, I'm kind of curious what your perspective is, but I would say the trajectory is probably going to be more towards a younger demographic. And I'll give you a quick aside. We purchased a Dairy Queen in Tavernier after Hurricane Irma, that next to my old high school. And the crew that I had come in were a bunch of young kids, high schoolers. And one of them says, because at the time I was the chairman of the Libertarian Party of Florida, he goes, "You're a libertarian? I'm a libertarian too. And my friends are libertarian." And I go, "Oh my God, I never would have thought to see, you know, somebody from my old high school, you know, a kid identify with libertarianism." And not only that, but he's got friends that are identified as libertarians. So to me, I think that we are doing a better job of, you know, getting younger people in, getting a more diverse group of people in from all walks of life. from all over the United States, whether you're blue collar, white collar, you know, man, woman, whether you're, you know, black or Hispanic or white or whatever. I see more and more people coming to the party than I think I have before, especially 10 years ago. That's been my personal experience. And I hope we get more of that.
Well, for those that don't know, I joined the party in 1998 as a, you know, an 18-year-old young man there. And so I've been in the party for a little while. Some people have been in longer than me. But I feel that when some people are like, oh, I've been in the party forever, like 4 years ago, I'm like, that's a short perspective sometimes on the party. So when Stephen is saying that we actually have improved greatly in those regards, we have. When I first came to the party, there were very few women in the party. We've actually have increased out here in Texas. I believe at one point we had all of our officers were women. So just to show how many were in here, and that just was accidental that it happened. It wasn't like we were pushing intentionally to do that. It was just that we have so many women in leadership now. And as we have women stay on and are developing in leadership, that also helps grow and outreach to women within the party. When women see themselves in those leadership positions, they can see themselves and want to listen to the message there. Everybody wants to see themselves in a way out there. So it builds, and as the party reaches out to more and more people, you'll see the party reflective of the greater population as we continue to grow. So it's just part of our early growth and development as we go on. I think we have a message that can appeal to women, and we also need to make sure that when we do outreach there, that it is tailored to women out there.
Okay. I think it was you, Stephen. You mentioned like some people are starting to wear suits and dress a little better and act more professional. Like,
sure.
To me, speaking as a woman, that's one of the things. Like, I went to the convention and some people took it seriously. And then I look around and some people look like maybe they haven't showered in a few days, or they don't know how to comb their hair, or I don't know. You got Star Child running around in some sort of fairy costume, which was kind of different. And Vivek was up there. I think Dave Smith was debating with him, and he's like holding a beer, and they made some genital jokes. And I'm like, well, this feels like a frat house. And as much as I like libertarian thoughts, it's just not kind of, I don't think other women want to be around that, if that makes any sense.
And I think,
and also libertarians, like I always have to go to the libertarianism. It never finds me. It's never on my feed. It's never TikTok videos. Mm-hmm. They're never the places I'm at. I feel like libertarians are just always in male places. So then women don't even know the Libertarian Party exists. Like my mom, she saw all the literature and stuff I'd brought home from the convention. And she's like, well, I didn't know I was a libertarian. I didn't know that they wanted to have drugs and vending machines and give everybody an AK-47. I'm down for that. But they're never in her. She's a baby boomer female. And she's like, this was never around. I just always thought it was Republicans and Democrats. So, I mean, that's my thought.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting perspective. I think, well, you know, I had a conversation with Justin Amash, and I asked Justin, I said, you know, do the Republicans have like these internal squabbles that you just never seem to hear about? Like, or is it just us? And he goes, oh yeah. And way more than you'd think. The Republicans and Democrats have their own fair share of internal issues or eccentric people or whatever. And you go to their conventions, I'm sure you'll see people in suits and people wearing, you know, crazy things that are whatever, right? And they just do a lot. They're just much bigger. And so it's easier for that to get lost within their own ranks. Whereas us, we're a lot smaller and the movement's a lot smaller. So we tend to see everything. And there tends to be this kind of libertarian TMZ where it's like, well, what's the latest drama within the Libertarian Party? Let's spread it all around. Where the Republicans and Democrats are so big that when crazy stuff happens, it often gets overshadowed. And I've seen it here locally in my own community with the Republican Party or the Democratic Party and whatever they've got going on. And at the national level, I'm sure there's things and I hear some things, but none of it essentially makes the news cycle because there's just so much going on. So to that regard, I think from what I've heard, from what Justin says, he actually sees more professional people within our party than the Republicans or Democrats. For whatever that's worth, I think that's complimentary, but also, you know, quite concerning, but it definitely gives us an opportunity to outshine them. And, you know, as for the relevancy, I think it's important for people to understand this and for your viewers to understand this. And I don't know what portion of your viewers are libertarian or just liberty loving folks or what have you. But since Ross Perot ran for president, he got 15% of the vote. And ever since then, ballot access became very, very difficult for third parties and independents, because the Republicans and Democrats came together and said, you know what? We can never have a crazy oil tycoon guy come in and threaten to overthrow the duopoly. So they created basically a ballot access cartel where they came together and they said, well, we're going to raise the barrier of entry. And, you know, in Tennessee, the Republican or Democrat can get 50 signatures in order to be on the ballot, but the Libertarian has to get, 25,000 signatures. Or in Texas, where in 2020, the Republicans and Democrats changed the law last minute, and the Republicans tried to sue the Libertarian Party off the ballot, but they didn't file in time, so they were unsuccessful. But then the Democrats sued the Green Party off the ballot. And so, going state by state, there's example by example by example by example of them trying to make us less relevant by making us spend millions of dollars every 4 years on ballot access and to maintain that ballot access. While simultaneously having the Commission on Presidential Debates, which has always been chaired by ex-Republican and Democrat committee members, and they spend billions and billions of dollars propping up their candidates, and they make the rules so difficult, it's impossible for a third-party independent voice to be on the stage with them. So as far as the American public is concerned, they believe that there's only two options and that nobody else is even worth listening to. So the Libertarian Party has been very successful over the past 50 years of building that ballot access structure. We've been the only third party to have 50 state ballot access plus DC and Guam, and to maintain that. The Green parties usually have around 20 to 30. I don't know what the last election their numbers were, but it doesn't come close to us. So even just to be on the ballot, even just to have a presidential candidate and have the opportunity to have somebody go out and be on the ballot, it's something that we've been fighting for, and it's very difficult to maintain and very costly, but it's something that, we're working on nonetheless. And that has certainly stonewalled us to, basically play on hard mode when it comes to saying, hey, we exist and we're out there and we'd love for you to join our party. And by the way, you might be a libertarian too. And I do believe at least a third of Americans are libertarian, maybe more. So there's definitely a lot of people out there that should be libertarian, but they just haven't found out. They haven't found out about us yet.
I want to switch a little bit of gears and talk about the Mises Caucus for a second, if that's okay. Jack Porter, I was reading an article about him, and he thinks that it's probably the end of the Mises Caucus as we know it. If you kind of go back and look at it, Recknerwald didn't win the presidential election. The person before that, or the vice president, didn't get the nomination. Michael Heiss, who was founded the Libertarian Mises Caucus, he lost to you. So people kind of feel like the Mises Caucus maybe is dead. Do you feel like the Mises Caucus has died? It was just a short-lived few years of revival of Ron Paulian and libertarianism, and now it's gone and another caucus will take its place? Or
it remains to be seen. I don't think the caucus has as much power as it did coming in 2022, nor the enthusiasm it once had. I do think the caucus brought in a lot of young people. I think it brought in a lot of more Rothbardian messaging, a lot of more hardcore messaging. I think that where they made one fatal mistake was the aggressive rhetoric of the takeover, which made a lot of people that were in the party uncomfortable that their presence was going to, basically come in and kick everybody out, that kind of thing. And I can only speak to my personal experience when it comes to the Mises Caucus. So, back in Florida, I was Florida State Chair. And when the caucus came in, a lot of young guys and gals, and I had to earn their respect. But I was able to, work with them in a way that, hey, we got these old timers that have a lot of knowledge. We've got these new folks that are full of piss and vinegar. So how can we put them both together and, set them off to go do good things? And I think Florida was successful at essentially, merging the Mises Caucus in with, the old timers there. And we got a lot of good stuff done in Florida when I was chair, and we didn't suffer a lot of the problems that a lot of states had with warring factions and tribalism. And I think tribalism will always be an issue in a Libertarian Party, unfortunately, especially if there aren't very clear goals. Because, you know, if you can unite the factions and say, look, you know, if we agree on this and this, we're going to move in this direction. Yeah, they're going to fight it out at convention. Yeah, they may not agree with each other. Yeah, there might be, you know, sparring and fighting or whatever. But if you can keep people on task, then you can try to prevent people from disintegrating into, you know, basically self-interest in different tribes and factions and just going to war with each other, because we're too small of a movement to fight each other over who gets to drive the bus. It's like, okay, where is the bus going? Where is it taking us? And we've always, the party's always been a tenuous coalition between classical liberals, you know, minarchists and anarchists. And I think if we can just come together and say, look, we're on a 100-mile journey. Let's not fight over the last three exits. Let's just get there. Let's move the Overton window, get libertarians in office, and then, you know, we'll fight it out when we can reduce the size and scope of government by 97%. We'll figure out the last 3%. If that's our mission, then I think we have a lot we agree on. Paul, what do you think?
The funny thing is, with the turnover in the Libertarian Party, I think the Mises Caucus would have become dominant at a time without all the takeover rhetoric, just because there's a natural cycle of people that, you know, you burn out over time, things happen, you leave, new leadership comes in. So without that rhetoric, they could have become the dominant portion of the party, and that might have changed the reception among a lot of people at that time. So that's just the natural cycle of the party. It cycles over and over again. And I wouldn't say the Ron Paul part of it is lost or anything like that, because even the existing party members, I remember in 2008, 2012, Ron Paul was, you know, a great way to bring people into the party. His message reached to the people there. They took around the rest of the Republican Party oftentimes and said, these guys don't really represent me. Only Ron Paul really does here. And they came over and joined the Libertarian Party. So we had our existing many Ron Paul Republicans that came into the party prior to the Mises Caucus coming up. So there was even, you know, you had Ron Paul supporters fighting Ron Paul supporters in many ways and in different aspects of how they wanted to do things. And it was really sad to see that happen in many cases there. So that's where I try to focus people on. Let's not fight each other within the party. You know, let's focus on fighting outside the party, fight our enemies outside the party. And that's, you know, try, if you want to compete on anything, compete on having the best candidates that are supporting your message outside the party to everyone out there. Focus on those things and make that happen. Myself, I do identify as a classical liberal, and I am a member of the classical liberal caucus out there. Won't hide the fact that that's what I am out there. I'm actually on their board still, trying to get off of it, actually, just so that others can be doing that. I have way too many hats at the moment, so that I'd rather have others hold that role, especially while I'm vice chair. I don't want to have that entanglement right now. But because I have supporters across the party, I have people that are actually many of the, while some of the leadership have expressed, you know, some in the Mises Caucus have expressed some skepticism of me there. There's many members that are just regular members of the Mises Caucus that are like, hey, Paul, I love that you're wanting to work with us here and do that. And let's get past all of this BS of fighting each other and just get the job done. And the people that just want to get crap done are willing to work with us here. And I really want to get to that point where we're just getting crap done. Forget all this this fighting that we've been having against each other. Some of it will still happen regardless, but that's fight outside. Our enemies are outside the party, not inside the party.
I will get off some of the party stuff before we have just a few minutes left here. Get to some of the fun stuff, issue-based things, of course, that involves Trump because he sucks all the air out of the room. How does the Libertarian Party, between the two of you all, are we going to deal with Trump and hold him accountable for his recklessness, for his lies? I was sitting right there at the convention when he said he was going to put a libertarian in his cabinet. He did not do that. I was really hoping for a Thomas Massie. Even though he's Republican, I would have went ahead and accepted that. But I felt like there was no accountability for that. Instead, I heard, well, RFK's a libertarian because he paid a fee to the party. And that just doesn't settle well with me, a Democratic dynasty like him. So all that that I said, how do you plan to hold Trump accountable? Are you going to ignore him because he just gets too much attention? Or are you going to take him down every single time he does something ridiculous?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think we can't ignore Trump. I think it's, you know, it's not smart to ignore what's going on at the federal level. I think when Trump does something good, we're going to praise it. And we're going to say what we want to achieve more. So, for instance, with Doge, it's like, this is great, but let's audit the Pentagon next. If you want to really, if you're serious about cutting government waste, fraud, and abuse, start with the Pentagon. They have trillions of dollars in black budget programs. They've failed every audit they've been given. And, you know, you look at where our money's going in the war on terror, for instance, which by itself is a whole issue. But, you know, every nut and screw and bolt costs $400, $100 here, $300 there. Where's this money going? It's a racket. It's a racket for the military industrial complex. It's a racket for people who want to grift off of the federal budget. And, you know, I was talking to the head of the Navy Public Works here in Key West. He just retired. And, you know, he goes, yeah, you know, you look at the quarters where all the soldiers and their families sleep on base. It's moldy. It's falling apart. The drywall is all gross, and there's a bunch of spalling. And it's been a known issue for decades. Yet the Pentagon has trillions of dollars that they've spent over the last 10 years, but none of it's going to the right places. So where is the money going? And you know, why are we as taxpayers funding it? It's a sacred cow of government, and Congress just pumps tons and tons of money into the national defense every year. But, you know, I don't know if they're reversing UFO technology or what, but I don't think it's making America more safe or prosperous. So that's a place where the government, you know, Doge needs to go and audit, for instance. And that's a place where libertarians can say, hey, like, we like what you're doing, but you need to do more of it. And not only that, but instead of saying, well, we're going to send $5,000 checks back to the American people as a bona fide rebate, we're actually going to cut taxes. And, you know, instead of saying, well, we're just going to use basically have a, give you a stimulus check based on projected savings over the next 10 years, we're going to cut government and cut these organizations. So I think it's important as libertarians not to be cynical contrarians every single time the government does something that we agree with, because then people aren't going to know, what do we actually want? So it's okay to say, yes, you know, I agree with, you know, Trump, or I agree with Elon Musk on this, but that doesn't mean we don't hold him accountable. We put out a very strong statement when Trump went out and said he wanted to take Gaza and make it American territory. And people were saying, well, you can't just believe Trump. He says all kinds of crazy things like we're going to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Well, apparently he was serious about that. So, you know, it's important. I think libertarians have traditionally failed at creating our own narrative and making sure that, you know, when something happens, we don't just say, well, we agree with the Democrats because, you know, we believe in this, or we agree with the Republicans on this. It's no, what is the libertarian, you know, narrative when it comes to X, Y, or Z issue? So I do plan on the party making strong statements and stances, you know, on the various issues from a libertarian policy perspective so that people know this is our policy and making sure it's out there. And, you know, quite frankly, over the years, as the Republicans and Democrats have been trying to court our vote, they have been noticing this, and they've been taking our policies and incorporating it into their platforms to try to, you know, get the libertarian voting bloc. So we will continue, you know, moving the needle in that direction, you know, through our voice. But ultimately, you know, the most important thing is going out there, getting libertarians elected, putting people in positions of power, because I don't trust, you know, Donald Trump to take us seriously and say we have a seat at the table, or, you know, we're a part of the movement or anything like that, because as soon as we're not useful, you know, we're going to be cast away. And so my message to libertarians, and I'm sure you saw my post earlier today on X, the point of that post was to say, look, you know, it's okay to have certain alliances or single issue coalitions temporarily, but don't mistake these people for our friends. They are our adversaries. You know, as far as RFK becoming Secretary of HHS, just like any other bureaucrat, you know, I will praise RFK when he does good libertarian things. But as soon as he steps out of line, we should be condemning him, because ultimately libertarians believe the HHS should not exist. And so you know, we will hold the politicians, their feet to the fire. And you know, we will let them know what we want to see and let our libertarian base know what we want to see in the process.
Yeah. I would say that it's really easy for people, and you often see this in the media, to fall into the trap of making weak arguments against Trump there. And that's where DTS really comes in, when people fall into that trap and they'll see something he does and just screech about it emotionally without stepping back, thinking about your principles, like Stephen was saying there, and having a very principled-based answer to what's going on there. And also just looking at the actual facts of what is going on with anything he says, because sometimes it'll get distorted by the media there. There is a kernel of truth surrounded by some falsehoods there. So getting down to what is the actual truth of what's going on there, making it fact-based in our response there, based on the principles of the Libertarian Party, is the importance to make that we praise when he does something good that is good done by libertarian principles, and then we hold him accountable when he does something that is not libertarian there. So there's going to be a mix of things for us to be happy about in the upcoming years.
I did want to get y'all's libertarian take on one thing Trump's done. Maybe y'all responded to it, maybe the party has, and I've just not seen it. But Trump has labeled cartels as terrorists, and then Pete Hegseth, his defense secretary, has said all options are on the table. So we could have airstrikes, we could have the military essentially fighting cartels. To me, that's just a massive move on the war on drugs, and things are going to get pretty violent pretty quickly. We'll start having soldiers get shipped home piece by piece, because the cartel is going to be worse than anything we fought before. I mean, what is y'all's take as the Libertarian Party? And why aren't more people calling that out? That seems terrifying to me when he said that.
Absolutely. I did put an X post out there, and I don't expect everyone to see my X posts, but I did put a statement out there about that. And, you know, I have no love lost for punishing the cartels. I think they're violent. I think they are an enemy of decent people. They do a lot of bad things, but okay, we can go out there and we can go to war with the cartels and start militarizing the border and even having military escapades into Mexico, trying to break up these groups. And that's not going to fix the solution. The solution, and most politicians aren't ready to admit it, and actually I think, and Trump even said this years ago, and he's probably flip-flopped on this since, but we need to legalize and decriminalize drugs in order to stop the cartels. So what does that look like? Because when a libertarian says, well, we need to legalize drugs, someone will say, well, I have a family that died of a heroin overdose. How could you say you want to legalize fentanyl or X, Y, and Z? And here's the nuanced point. Portugal and Amsterdam both decriminalized drugs. They saw a decrease in addictions. They saw a decrease in HIV from needle use. They saw a decrease in people, you know, using drugs in general. And what they did is they said, okay, you know, we're going to look at the drug issue from a public health standpoint. And the people that are addicted to hardcore drugs or whatever that want to get helped, they can get the help they need. And I would much rather see the private sector, hospitals, accountable businesses be the ones to treat this problem than the government just throwing people in prison cells over it. Because the reality is most drug use happens, especially hardcore drug use, happens to people who are, they've basically been, they don't have a social network. These are people without steady employment. They have mental health issues. They have many, many issues that you're using drugs as a crutch in order to try to numb them to the fact that you know, they've lost control of their life. So if we start looking at the drug use issue as a sickness of the soul rather than a criminal offense, then we can say, okay, you know, let's start treating people. And then for consenting adults that want to partake in drugs, recreational drugs like cannabis or MDMA or psilocybin or cocaine or whatever it be, you know, there should be a way that they can partake, because the drugs are already there. They're already on the street. They're already accessible. And for whatever reason, they're containing a lot of fentanyl and other things that are killing people. And there's some theories as to why that's getting into drugs these days. But if it's got powder in it, it's probably got fentanyl in it. So when you take drugs away from the black market and you make it you clean it up, you make sure, you know, there's accountability there. Then you start to solve the drug problem, get people treatment, et cetera. Now, when you look at the opioid epidemic, when OxyContin was released by Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the FDA agreed that it was not addictive. And because these pharmaceutical companies benefit through regulatory capture, they benefit through immunity from being sued, victims can't get compensation. The FDA, the DEA blocked out non-addictive alternatives to these drugs. And then when people could no longer get the OxyContin or get, you know, the drugs they were addicted to, then all of a sudden they were going to heroin and opium and, you know, different drugs on the street in order to satiate their addiction. So a lot of this mess is created by the government. It was upheld by the government. And the only way to get money away from the cartels is to take away their revenue stream, which is drugs and the war on drugs. When the United States legalized cannabis, or at least decriminalized it in many states, it started to take away that market from the underground, you know, drug trade, the black market. During Prohibition, you know, bootlegging and gangs existed to bring that product in the United States. I live in the Florida Keys. Everybody down here in the 80s was bringing in cocaine and cannabis. And back in the cocaine cowboy days through South Florida, it was a thing that happened. Now it all goes through the Mexican border. You know, when you take away the demand is never going to go away. So you need to shift supply from the black market to the legal market and shift the mindset towards, you know, treating the disease rather than, you know, punishing the victim. And then you'll see these cartels lose their grip. Until that happens, they're going to continue to be empowered. They're going to continue to make a lot of money. And now we're going to have to go to war with them because they become so powerful that, you know, they become a national security threat. So that's the only way it's going to be fixed. I doubt it. Maybe move the conversation in that direction, but yeah, I don't think that's going to come out of the Republican Party anytime soon, or even the Democratic Party for that matter.
I would just add, yeah, fully on board with the drug legalization there. Even though a lot of people don't know, I grew up in foster care. So my father was a drug dealer and my mother was a prostitute before I went into the foster care system. So I've seen the ugly side of the black market of drugs out there and some of the things that can happen with that. But when you have a market and you suppress it and you have that black market, that's when you enable bad people to do bad things. So if we have, like Stephen was saying, a market that is open, that has sunshine on it, that you know what the product is out there, and that you are able to have those healthcare options for those that need it out there, easily accessible, where they aren't in fear of going to jail over needing to get help out there, you'll have a better market and you'll have less of those bad things that happened to me as a kid due to that black market that was out there. So that will definitely help alleviate the problem with the cartels south of us there. And I would even go further on the immigration front. I'm not a completely open, I'm probably going to make everybody in the party mad because it seems to be split different ways. I'm not a completely open borders, but I'm not a bordertarian on things, as we kind of refer to those names out there. I am one of those that, you know, was talking about early on about having a fast immigration system, efficient, and that we process people through very quickly and allow them to work in the U.S. and have that documentation out there. I guess some people take away my libertarian card on even wanting to have any process out there. But I think we, you know, in the technology today, that we could have that fast and efficient. And that's also a revenue stream for those cartels out there. They've diversified the revenue streams through drugs, through controlling immigration, and through just being able to do other revenue things that they do down there. So by taking those two legs of their support out from underneath them, we can do a lot more in the United States than anything else. I've also been, you know, coming out of foster care, I was a soldier in the United States Army for a time. So I deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. And I can tell you that, you know, fighting the asymmetric warfare that our soldiers would be doing down in Mexico is an incredibly difficult task, and one that we never really succeeded on We were, you know, very good at killing people across overseas, but it never brought the change that people wanted to see in those countries. Even people that went there for the best of intentions, like myself, wanting just to support myself and make change in the world there, saw how you were using the completely wrong tool for change there. A military is built to kill people, is not built to change things in a country. You need to be aware of that's what a military is for, and not use a military except when, you know, you're in defense of your own country, the absolute last, you know, thing we should be using it for. So we shouldn't be proactively trying to have action in Mexico without, you know, there needs to be some congressional oversight, you know, as far as that goes. As the Defend the Guard comes to mind when I think about that. We need congressional oversight on that. And some people might be, you know, suddenly step away from thinking we need that congressional oversight, but we need to buy into the people. We also need to be actually working with our partners south the border if we're actually going to be doing anything like that. But I would say, you know, if we do those other two steps we talked about, you might, we might not have that on the discussion board with anyone anyways. That might help the Mexican people able to have regain control of the areas in their country and be able to fight off those individuals that are causing the trouble themselves. So that's just a few of my thoughts there.
Do you want to tell the audience where they can find you all online, on social media, and how they can join the Libertarian Party?
Yeah, absolutely. you can find me on X, Stephen Nikala, and I would encourage everyone to go over to lp.org, check out the platform. And if you agree with 70 or 80% of what we believe, I would encourage you to consider becoming a member. You don't have to change party affiliation to do so. You can become a dues-paying Libertarian member. You can also sign up to the newsletter and stay up to date with what's going on in the party. And I would encourage people to check out our Project Decentralized Revolution. It's our project to get Libertarians elected at the local level nationwide. So if you're interested, you can donate towards that project over at lp.org. You can also reach out to your local affiliate and see who's running for office, or run as a candidate yourself and be the change you wish to see in the world. So thank you so much, Courtney. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on.
You can always email us if you're within the party and have specific questions for myself at paul.dar@lp.org. And on X, you can find me at paul_dar. But I use it only sparingly there, posting some things on occasion. I'm not the biggest X user of libertarians out there. Some people for some reason love it so much, but I use it sparingly out there. You can also find me at paul.dar.org. I have my own little blog that I post things to occasionally there, where it's a mix of things. So it could be anywhere from libertarian topics to me posting about my own church topics that I like to talk about, or boring stuff of just life and farm, you know, doing home gardening and stuff like that I like to do. So that's where you can find me.
Now that you know where we've been, find out where we're going. Tune in to Ladies Love Politics, where you can stay informed without going insane.